I always have a bottle of water in my car because mm-hmm. I have run out of water, but like, at least I know if I get back to my car, I'm going right. to live, you know, yeah. stuff like that. So
the rail line was reassuring for me too, because it's yeah. like, well, I can't get, I'm not just going out no. into the middle of nowhere. Right.
Right.
I can always just right. find the rail line and
right.
follow it back out until I,
yeah, I don't, out. I mean, I guess, I mean, before, I've done it where they've fenced it off and I've crawled under the fences.
Yeah. Don't know? Worry. We'll beep that out of the podcast.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
The Senge 4 Podcast. I'm Aaron Drews.
And I'm Stephen Horvath.
We've got a bonus episode of the podcast today with my friend and mentor, Dr. Jan Talbot.
Hello, I'm Jan Talbot. I'm a professor of chemical engineering at UC San Diego. You know, my son does music and recording him and stuff. They always have some setup like this.
Yeah. I didn't know he did music. Yeah. What kind of music does he do?
He plays piano.
Oh, really?
Keyboard, and keyboard, yeah. Oh. Yeah. He's played since he's a little kid. He's, you know, he was a child prodigy. But now, you know, I mean, he's blind. And so he can just hear anything and play it. I mean, we'll go to a symphony and we'll come home and it goes, Mom, would you like me to play Tchaikovsky's blah, blah, blah? You know, we just heard.
Like, yes, please.
Yeah. And then he does, and on the keyboard, he does the whole orchestration. I mean, wow. he makes it sound like an orchestra. Yeah. It's so weird. I mean, it's so amazing. Yeah. And then when he was a little kid, he'd go, oh, let's go to the movies. I'm thinking, oh, you know, what? He'd come home, he'd play all the movie music. He loves film music. In fact, this for Christmas, I always get him CDs. And he had, I want the film music by Hans Zimmer, Max Steiner, and John Williams.
Yeah.
Okay, all right. And he, because I've gone to those movies, Mom. I'm like, yeah, but, you know, he just listens to the music. He loves. And for a while, it was hilarious. When he was little, he was, Mom, when I grow up, I want to write movie music.
Like, absolutely, okay. Yeah. Has he been to any of the? They started doing something with like the Harry Potter movies, where you would go to the orchestra and they would, you know, show the movie with all of the audio in the background, but they would cut the music and then the orchestra would play the music live.
Right.
And I went to see, I think it was like the third Harry Potter.
Yeah.
That they did that, and it was so cool.
Isn't that cool? I've gone to that too for various movies. I don't know if it was Harry Potter, but I've done the San Diego. It is amazing.
Yeah.
And yeah. He's pretty wild. You know. He will ask me, I want to hear the New York Philharmonic play, you know, Harry Potter's blah, blah, theme for whatever. I'm like, because he can do it. He goes, oh, Mom, do you use Google Chrome? You know, do you like, he can do searches. Right. And people at his, they go, we don't know how he does it. He just finds all this crazy stuff, you know. So, because he's also mentally disabled too, so he's, you know, I don't know, maybe like a kind of a 10-year-old kind of, you know, maybe not even that. I mean, he's kind of scattered what his capabilities are, but for music, it's really profound. It really is.
So I feel like with the holidays, that's kind of a double-edged sword, because on the one hand, you know exactly what to get him, but on the other hand, he's going to know if you don't get him exactly the right music that he's requested, because he'll be able to hear the difference and we wouldn't be able to hear it.
There's no surprises. He just gives me the list, you know.
Yeah. You know, it's easier that way.
It's just easier. Yeah. And he has a job. I mean, he's very proud of himself that he has a job.
Yeah.
Not that he gets paid or anything, but he goes to a nursing home 5 days a week, and every day he plays a different type of music, a different genre.
Yeah.
He has classical Wednesday, I remember. And what's Monday? It's something like, you know, old music. So just amazing. And then he has movie Thursdays and Fab Four Friday.
What's Fab Four Friday?
Fab Four? Come on.
Well, I remember the Fab Five, but I think that's completely different.
The Beatles.
Oh, okay. See? I was thinking Fab Five, which are the guys that do the makeovers on like Netflix or something. Yeah. I was like, I didn't know they had a music following or anything.
Yeah,
like that.
No, the Fab Four.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, so, they've got a big enough sort of repertoire that he could probably play them for years.
Yeah. And since Thanksgiving, he goes into Christmas music mode. He loves Christmas. I'm not a big Christmas fan, but when you're around him, you can't help but you have to. He just loves Christmas.
Yeah.
And it's the music. It's the music, you know. So it's like, yeah. So this year's going to be a little different because usually he's on so many gigs playing Christmas music. So, you know.
Yeah.
But now, you know, he's pretty much quarantined.
Yeah.
You know, in his group home. So, yeah. Anyway.
That was always something when I was, not even just when I was growing up, but I've continued to think like, I wish I knew how to play piano. Like, I wish that had been a part of me growing up.
Yeah.
Because it's just such a beautiful, versatile instrument.
Yeah.
You can play with friends. You can play by yourself. It's,
so
much history to it. I love the piano, but it's just never been something that I've been able to dedicate that kind of time to.
I'm really amusical. I mean, so Matt, when he was four, he asked me for a piano teacher. I mean, it's pretty scary. You know, those toy pianos, he could, at like one or two or whatever, could play songs on those.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you're like, I recognize that song. It's very scary.
And not
scary.
Like I used to cheat playing songs where I hit the play button on the little piano and it plays.
It was scary. So then I got him a keyboard, a little keyboard, and he could, you know, then at four, he said, Mom, get me a piano teacher. So I got him, I put an ad in the UCSD newspaper, you know, and a student off, because nobody would take him at four. Yeah. They just said, no way. And she came for half an hour a week. And she's an attorney. I still in contact with her, you know, and she like, what do I do? I could just play, let him, you know, he'll play with you. So then when he was five, I got Suzuki, and Suzuki, the parents are supposed to play. That's supposed to encourage the child, you know? And so I was trying to learn these little Mozart, and I'm terrible. And so the first day we go, you know, he says to the teacher, does she have to play?
Oh,
like,
no.
Get rid of her, you know? She goes, oh, I guess we'll skip that step where the parent is playing, you know? Like, oh, thank you.
Oh, thank you. Everybody wins.
Everybody wins. And when he was, so he was there about a month, and they had she had maybe 10 students or something. And she had a recital at her house. And so she said, you know, Matt, of all these songs, you know, what song do you want to play? He goes, oh, I want to play my own song. And she's like, what?
Okay.
He goes, she goes, well, does it have a name? She goes, oh, yes. He goes, it's the Carousel. He used to be a commuter on the carousel, at, you know, the park. I mean, he just, right. He loved, but it was all the music. So he plays this song and he could repeat it. It was called The Carousel. It sounded just like a carousel. Wow. Yeah. So he played that at his first recital at five, played his own composition. Like,
wow.
Yeah. But anyway, it's fun. I miss him at the holidays because he's like parties. Oh my gosh. You take him to parties. He used to play at the MAE Christmas party every year.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Amazing. You know, and he could, I don't know how he did it. He would come up, you know, somebody would come up to him and he'd go, I could play this for you. And they go, that's my favorite song. How do you know that? I mean, he would just, it's spooky. Yeah. He's really pretty amazing like that.
Yeah. Have you been able to spend some time with him with COVID? Cause it's made everything so hard.
No. And one of the house, they have, this is a center for blind, developmentally disabled people. And there's probably, 100 clients. Mm-hmm. And because it's in LA. So they have a big enough population. So this very rare, you know, combination of disorders, they have enough people. Somebody I don't know, 40 years ago, established this facility. It's really fabulous. And so they have these group homes. Mm-hmm. And one of the group homes, somebody, one of the workers got COVID. And so several of the clients got COVID and they shut. Yeah, so it was very scary. And so, so they're shut. So the houses are all basically isolated and, you know, except for the staff that comes in.
Yeah.
So, and they go out for walks and things like that, but that's about it. Cause they all touch each other. I mean, right. It's really hard for them not to touch you. So I could go see Matt like from a distance, but it would be ridiculous, you know, right. In the sense right. I can just, call him and, right. You know, and he doesn't really, it's very hard. He doesn't get it. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, he knows about COVID.
Sure.
COVID. He goes, COVID.
That should be the new national way that we say it. Exactly.
He goes, I know you can't see me because of COVID. That's hilarious. Anyway, yeah, so it's tough. But, you know, every weekend I remind him, you know, when I talk to him, I said, listen, you have people who care about you or taking care of you.
Right.
You're with your five. He's in a group home with, there's six of them. I say, with your five buddies, and you get to play piano all day long.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, oh, okay. You know, I get to play piano.
Silver lining in there. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, that's good. Yeah. He is very well taken care of. So, mm-hmm. You know, so that's good. Well, and then my son, that's the whole story of my son there.
What about you? Have you been, I mean, there's so little that we can do, certainly with other people, but I know you like to hike a lot. Have you been able to hike much?
Yeah.
During the...
So I have a small group of friends mm-hmm. That are, you know, my age that I've known them for years that we've raced together and trained together for all these crazy races that I do. And
For the
triathlon.
Folks listening to us right now. Yeah. I was going to ask, like, when you say races, what kind of races are we talking about?
So triathlons mainly, but also running. I used to be a runner also, but I switched to triathlons. And now I don't run at all, and I do aqua bikes, which are just, So, but I've been, really since I came to UCSD, I found this group, a master's group that was a bunch of women. Mm-hmm. Well, there's guys too, but there was really a group of women who are my age, who all discovered after their children had grown that they were athletes. Because I was before Title IX and I did modern dance in high school. I mean, some of the girls who live in California or women, they did swimming. They had swimming programs, but none of us did any athletics really to speak of.
Right.
So all of us figured out later on that, you know, we can run, we can swim, because there's not very many women in this, our age group, mm-hmm. when we go to races, we always win. I got hooked on the bling. I have so many medals. It's really, the guys get so disgusted with us because we are so slow, you know, compared to them.
I mean, you're lapping us though, because I'm just sitting over here on my couch. So you're lapping everybody like me.
Well, you know, anyway, every morning. So when I worked, I used to get up and 6 o'clock, you know, meet this group for an hour every day. And then on the weekends, do longer 2 or 3 hour hikes or runs, or, if we were, training, I did marathons and then, and then a bike ride, then maybe a 2 or 3 hour bike ride. So, but now that I'm retired, we meet and I do at least 2 hours of exercise a day.
Wow. That's nice. So is that just sort of a mixture of, you know, what feels good that day, or do you have a schedule? Like, I'm going to bike here and run, or the, what do you do? How do you approach
it? Because I was doing these races, I had kind of a training plan, mm-hmm. and I qualified for, so I went to a national race. You had to qualify this, and it was all, you know, age groupers, and it was a qualifying race for the world's competition. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I came in second. It was the worst race I've ever had.
Yeah.
But somehow I came in second.
Wow.
And it was a 1.2 mile swim and a 56 mile bike ride.
Jeez.
Yeah. Yeah. So you just don't, you have to train for something like that. Yeah. Right. And it's not in the pool, you know, it's in the ocean or a lake. This was in Florida, outside of Miami, near a lake with the signs that say, beware of alligators.
Mm-hmm.
That was really scary.
Yeah.
You know?
No, thank
you. I'm like,
I will take that sign at its word and just kind of keep my eyes.
Yeah. I was like, oh, anyway. So I was going to go to Worlds, which was outside of Amsterdam, this past September.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a friend who, she retired from UCSD as a, she was one of the rec coaches there.
Mm-hmm.
And so I said, she does private coaching. So, she set up a whole schedule for me because the race that I'm supposed to do in Amsterdam, which hopefully will happen next year in September. It's twice the distance. It's a 2.1 mile, which I've done 2 miles of swimming, but I've never done 112 mile bike ride afterwards.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's like an Ironman without the running.
Right.
So everybody says,
we wouldn't want to make it too hard, right? No.
So I thought, I'm not going to do this, you know, but all my friends said, oh, you can do it. You can do it. So anyway, you have to train for something like that.
Yeah.
So I was ready, you know, getting ready to do that. But then COVID happened. And so I thought, well, I'm going to still, I have this coach who every day tells me what to do.
Right.
You know, and what she mainly tells me is don't do that. Because that's my big issue is I would hurt myself.
Yeah.
I would train too much.
Yeah.
So instead of overtraining, she says, go out and do this, and this will make you faster, or this will build your endurance. And so I really enjoy it. It's really fun to have someone write me little notes. Oh, you did a good job.
Yeah. You know? For a while, I was going over to the YMCA, both my wife and I, prior to our wedding, because we're like, oh, well, we got to get in wedding shape, blah, 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 blah. Which of course happened right before COVID, and they're like, oh, we said, well, what a shame, we can't go out and work, oh, that's terrible. But I remember thinking similarly, because somebody finally formally explained to me why there are so many mirrors when you go into a gym, something like that. It's not, you're not supposed to be just like admiring yourself, although everybody does it when they there, but it's like, no, that's you're supposed to be able to, you know, look at your form, because it's not about the amount of weight that you can lift, it's about the technique you're using to lift the weight.
Right.
You can do far more damage with a lot of weight than if you were to do the correct form with very little weight.
Right.
It sounds similar, right? We need people to tell us what we're doing wrong, not
exactly. So so anyway, so in retirement, I also do some, you know, extreme hiking. So I go to, you know, up to 15,000 feet and the mountains, and I hike days on end in Bhutan or, you know, someplace exotic place, which I want to do. I want to do as long as I can do. And so
you sound then like the perfect guide, because I've been wanting to go out into Anzo Borrego.
Oh, yeah.
And there's an old trestle bridge out there. Have you heard of the trestle bridge?
I've gone over it.
Have you been there? Oh, good.
Yeah.
Because I want to go out there, and they've warned everyone who reads it, like, don't try it on your own, right? Make sure that you take somebody else who knows how to hike in the desert.
Oh, okay. I could take you.
Okay.
I haven't been out there in a while. And my last two hikes I went on, the trails had changed. I hadn't been out. And I'm sure that trail has changed too. But I know where, I mean, I kind of, but you kind of need a high clearance vehicle, at least you used to get to the trailhead. But
yeah, I was looking at a couple of different places where you could pick up the trail. And
yeah.
One was over in, there's like a development now, and you can kind of park there, and you have to hike through basically nothing, right? It's desert, but there's no trail or anything, and that takes you to the rail line, and then you just take the rail line all the way out, and every now and then, you know, you'll come across, there's like I think 7 or 8 tunnels.
Yeah.
And some of them are now collapsed. And so right. you have to just make up your own route, right? And go up and right. over.
Yeah.
Or, you know, down through a valley.
Right. I've done
something
that.
Like that. And I don't have it down here with me, but I bought like a little compass and everything. And I was learning how to like take bearings and mark them on the map yeah. and all of this stuff, just because it's such an interesting.
Yeah. Anza Borrega is very rugged. And that area, that Cariza Gorge is very rugged.
It's
very rugged.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, but, you know, just do little hikes for, do a couple little hikes in Anza Borrega, mm-hmm. you know, figure out how much water you need to drink, mm-hmm. you know, I always have a bunch of water in my car because mm-hmm. I have run out of water, but like, at least I know if I get back to my car, I'm going right. to live, you know, yeah. stuff like that. So
the rail line was reassuring for me too, because it's yeah. like, well, I'm not just going out no. into the middle of nowhere. Right.
Right.
I can always just
right.
find the rail line and
right.
follow it back out until I,
yeah, you know. Before, I've done it where they fenced it off and I've crawled under the fences.
Yeah. Don't know. Worry. We'll beep that out of the podcast.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. But there's also, you know, for a while it was open to hikers. So I don't know what do you know what the status is? I haven't been
it's
out there.
It's closed
so
off
long.
Now.
Oh, it is closed yeah. off. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Mm-hmm. There was, they at least said back in like, I think 2018, 2019, that the company that owned that rail line was thinking of rehabilitating it
right.
and actually starting to use it again. But
yeah, they cleaned out, they had because they had to excavate all these tunnels that were collapsed. Yeah. And so they actually opened it up for a day. I went out there so you could actually walk legally on the whole thing before they had trains on it. And they only ran trains for a little while and then they shut it down again.
Oh,
but because right. I was hoping they were going to have, you know, excursions so people could take, because it is beautiful, beautiful yeah. gorge. Oh my gosh. You don't even know. I mean, it's almost unbelievable how they built that railroad there. Mm-hmm. It's crazy.
Yeah. Because it's not just that trestle too, right? There's five or six or seven
yeah.
more trestles,
right.
not quite as large, but I
right.
mean, throughout the whole length of it. Yeah. It's just, either you're going through a tunnel to get through a mountain or you're going over a bridge to get over
yeah.
a valley. It's
yeah.
like, wow,
yeah.
it's just such a remarkable
yeah, the first time you went to the biggest trestle, mm-hmm. it looked really rickety.
Oh,
and
really?
So, and then, but I saw these two people walk across, you know, and I thought, oh, okay. But I was not going to do it. And my friend was with me, goes, well, I dare you, which is the only thing he had to say, which then I walked across. Okay.
Yeah. I'm going to have to build up, like I biked a lot back and forth to work, you know,
yeah.
pre-COVID, and then COVID hit. And now it's, I mean, even right before COVID, there was a solid quarter there where I just didn't bike anymore.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it just sort of petered off for a while.
Yeah.
The bike went in for some maintenance, and it took...
Oh, yeah.
I think it ended up taking like 3 months or something for them to finally fix it.
Yeah.
And then I got on the bike a couple of weeks ago or maybe a month ago. I was like, man, it's you got to start all over again with a gap that yeah. big. And I used to hike a lot out at Penn State through very different terrain, but... It's been so long since I've done that too that I probably need to start all over again with,
yeah, you
with
just
hiking too.
Do little hikes and then just yeah. build up. I mean, I do that. You know, I don't just go out and well now. I mean, I can, but you know, because I do usually 8 or 10 miles on the weekend of hike. That's that. But still, if I'm going up to altitude,
yeah,
it's hard. Mm-hmm. It's hard. Yeah. So you know, I have to take it one step at a time. And I, you know, have to know when to turn around, you know, when it's
right.
like, you know, when you're, no, you're not going to make it back.
Yeah.
You don't
yeah.
turn around. You know?
Yeah. So, that was always nice in Penn State because the weather was enough and I was prepared enough in that area where it's like, even if worse comes to worse, I can put the little hammock up and I have enough food to get through the night and I can just go in the morning when I've got
yeah.
more energy.
Yeah.
And it's like, I have none of that experience, and B, I have none of that gear if I was to walk out into the middle of Anza Borrega and
yeah,
get stuck
yeah.
for a night.
Yeah.
I couldn't just hold it out.
Well, after COVID, we'll go out there. I'll take you out there. There's
Let's
some,
do
it's,
it. Yeah.
I love, I'm like, I really want to go now. I want to go camping out there,
yeah.
but, you know, it's just, if anything happened, then it would be a burden on the whole system. So
are you saying that you think I'm going to be a burden because I'm not going to be able to make it?
No, I'm just saying with COVID, if something happened, the medical system is so impacted right now.
Right.
I don't want to take a chance that something, I don't think nothing's ever happened to me or any of my people I've taken out there, but just
in case. Yeah. You have to think about what could happen.
Right. Right.
Yeah. So. I will let a friend of mine know that I went to grad school with, because he's now over in DC, and I showed him this set of trails, and he's like, when this is over, I'm coming out there and we're doing that, because we used to hike together a lot back at Penn State. So I'm taking you up on that. That's going to happen. All
right. I love it. I love taking, because the desert is really subtle, and I like I like taking people out there because I'm so used to, I see all kinds of things, that I think it's so, it's kind of weird. You see nothing and then you see too much, once you like, oh, look at this. And you have to be aware of all the cactus and, but I love it. It's such a beauty. And what I like is the quiet. It is so quiet. Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh. It's just, you can hear like inside your head, like the blood or something. I don't know. It's very weird, but there's so many amazing places out there.
That was what I loved about the area just above Palm Springs. Palm Springs is out in the desert anyway.
Yeah.
But we stayed at a little cabin, like way off the beaten path, like behind a mountain or something like that. And you would go out in the middle of the night, and finally there was no traffic noise, right? And you could just hear everything.
Nothing.
Yeah. Everything and nothing. Like there was nothing going on, but a little animal scurried away over there. It's just completely different. Yeah.
Yeah. I love it. I love it. Yeah.
I guess speaking of Penn State, I didn't know that we actually shared an alma mater. You went to Penn State for your BS and your MS, right?
I knew that.
I didn't know that. This is news to me.
Aaron, I think we talked about Penn State before.
Did we?
Yeah.
Oh, no.
Early, way back when.
Yeah.
Way back when. Yeah.
I have forgotten about it, and now I have rediscovered it with a great joy all over again.
Yeah.
I didn't know that. Did you grow up in the area of Penn State?
My parents, people always ask me about growing up, and I say I never grew up, but I my dad was in the Army, and so we lived all over the world. Mm-hmm. But my dad took a second, he retired from the military and got a job in Carlisle at Dickinson College as their head of security. He was in the military police. So anyway, so my whole family, my brothers went to high school in Pennsylvania. My mom's from Pennsylvania, from Avoca, if you know where that is.
It's near I don't know where that is.
That's near Scranton, Wilkes-Barre area.
Yeah.
It's where the airport is. That's why everybody will know Avoca. Growing up, because we would travel all over the place, we would go back to my mom's hometown in Avoca. And I went to first grade in Avoca, and that was our kind of our base for, so Pennsylvania was sort of my home state, and that's why I went to Penn State. Because, I was in state.
Right? Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So. I think we've done, I don't know if Pennsylvania has done the same thing, but I really love the direction California is going with the in-state stuff for, it's people who live here. I think now we're up to 2 years of community college that you can take for free. I don't know if Penn State was doing the same thing, but I benefited from that in Ohio too, where I stayed in state and got a significantly lower tuition. I think it's so great.
Yeah, exactly.
And then what? So your background all the way through was chemical engineering, right? BS chemical, master, doctor, it was all chemical engineering. Was there something that drew you to the profession in the first place? Because I remember hearing about it and I had no idea what it was. I just kind of lucked into something that I found that I really enjoyed. What pushed you into there?
So when I was in high school, I was always really taking advanced math. I mean, I took calculus. I got basically placed out of two classes of calculus because of my high school calculus. And so I was always like a whiz at math and stuff. And I was also, just a good student. I mean, I liked everything, and I liked art a lot.
Yeah.
And so I one summer I worked for a commercial artist just as a gopher, but they were hiring. And when I saw people come in with portfolios of things that I was just blown away with, I thought, oh, there's no way I can make it in as an artist, you know? And for me, so I was the first person in my family to go to college. So I had very little, my parents did not understand what college was about, did not save money for college for me. They gave me $1,000 and said, have fun at college.
Good luck.
Yeah. So I got out all kinds of loans.
Yeah.
And I worked. I worked at least 20 hours a week at college. So anyway, I didn't know a lot about college, except that I knew I had to have a job that paid.
Right.
And so people told me that engineering, I could get a BS in engineering and I could make money, you know, I would have a good living. And that was really, you know, I didn't come from a poor family, but my parents were clueless about, you know, I think what a difference in education could make. So, and I knew I didn't want to depend on them at all for, you know, and I think there, you know, it was that time frame, you know, I was a pioneer that in this field because there were hardly any women. There were seven women in engineering total at Penn State.
Wow.
And 3,000 men.
Yeah.
And so I was the only woman in chemical engineering until my junior year when a transfer student came in. And so there were two of us. And in chemical engineering.
Yeah.
And I think the class was around 60.
It's a good growth rate, but they still need to work on those numbers a little bit.
And then when I, so when I, anyway, it's, you know, crazy story, but I liked math. I liked science. And my worst subject, which meant getting a B, was chemistry. And so my counselor in high school said, pick something that, you know, you're good at. And I thought, that's going to be boring, you know, because I can do all this stuff. I know I'd love to do art, but that's going to be, you know, prohibitive because it's just going to be a hobby for me. And so I said, what do I do the worst in? Chemistry. And that's going to be a challenge for me and keep me interested forever. And it did. I mean, it was the worst, you know, it was so funny because it was like the opposite of what I was told to do. But it worked for me, my personality, where I hate being bored. And I have never been bored, ever. And it has been, it's not come easy, chemical engineering. It's always been a challenge.
Yeah.
But I loved it. I loved it. And so.
That's one area I think I've sort of gone back to a little bit more is when I first started, I like to stay in those classes that I did well in. As a teacher, I mean, I like to teach the classes I did well in myself. And now you kind of get to that point where you can see what you described of, if I keep doing this, I'm going to be bored. And so you look around, like, what are the other classes that I could teach? And I'm more drawn to those ones that were hard for me now. It's like, I want to get back and I want to get those better than I ever did the first time around, and then try to help other people not encounter the same stumbling blocks that I did. So those hard ones are actually where I'm sort of drawn. More than I used to be.
Yeah. So, I had a fortunate, being the only woman in almost all my classes, I mean, I would go into physics and chemistry lectures and I would be the only woman.
Yeah.
You know, 300 people. I mean, one, you know, professor would come out and say, good morning, gentlemen. And I go.
For anybody listening to our podcast, she was waving her arm very enthusiastically.
So I'd wave my arm very enthusiastically. And then he started saying, good morning, gentlemen and lady. I don't know. I just found it. People often say, oh, you know, you were the only one. Were you discriminated against? All that? And I don't remember anything except that I was focused.
Yeah.
You know, and I really wanted to learn this stuff. And it wasn't easy. It was not easy. And like I said, I had to work And I was looking around, you know, I was thinking I was going to have to be a waitress in the dorm or something, you know, in the mess, what do you call the halls for the dining halls. And my roommate, so what, I had a lot of really good things happen. So my college roommate, my first roommate, was a nuclear engineer. So there were two of us, right? She was the only one in nuclear engineering. And she got a job as a health physics technician at the nuclear reactor. But then she found out she could be an operator. They had a student program.
Yeah.
And you could pay to be, I don't know if you've ever been to the Brazilian nuclear reactor on campus.
I've walked past it outside a few times and yeah. it was
never compelled to go inside.
I figured my PI would be like, no, you don't have time to do that. Get back in the lab and do the research.
So anyway, she, you know, I think our second or third quarter, she had that job and she came, I was looking around, I desperately needed a job. Mm-hmm. And she said, Jan, why don't you take my job? I'll recommend you. And I'm going to take the traineeship, which I get paid for. I get paid more than I would be at this job. So I went, oh, great.
Yeah.
So, cause it was a technical job and I could work as many hours as I want, but I worked typically 15 to 20 hours a week. And then I stayed in the summers because I could work even more in the summers at the reactor.
Right. Right.
And my boss was a chemical engineer.
Oh, wow.
So
how convenient.
So I would be doing my homework, you know, while I was counting samples or doing whatever, all the, you know, some of the more tedious work, you know, and he'd come in, he goes, Jan, you need to prime this pump. I'm like, oh, I know Bernoulli's equation. No idea, right? I'm like, what are you talking about? What does that mean, you know? Oh my gosh. So he taught me all these practical things, you know? So I'd say, well, what's this equation have to do with that pump? You know? Yeah. And so it was fabulous. It was like, you know, kind of like our, Seng 4 lab, like, but I had it at work and, cause we didn't have anything like that until our, you know, lab, I had chemistry lab in senior year. Right.
Yeah.
So, so that was, any kind of question I had, he knew the practical side of it and would, so that was a fabulous, just set of circumstances that I had this technical job and, you know, he was a chemical engineer and was, you know, kind of took me under his wing. So that was really great. And, so then, when I graduated, one of the two women I got, it was during a recession and people were sending out hundreds of resumes and not getting jobs or getting one job. So I got one job interview for Babcock and Wilcox in Akron, Ohio.
Hey, that sounds familiar.
Yeah. And designing boilers. Uh-huh. And so I was going around and they'd show me, some of the guy was doing some kind of calculation or something interesting. I go, well, what about that guy? What about his job? And they go, well, if you had 5 years experience or a master's degree.
Yeah.
And I'm like, what's a master? I had no clue.
Yeah.
So when I came back, I started asking around, like, what is this master's degree? And so it turned out this, man I was dating, he said, well, I'm going to stay here for my master's. I don't want to go out in the job force right now because the job market's so bad. So I thought, well, I can do that.
Right.
The other thing was that because I went summers, I graduated in 3 years. Mm-hmm. So I was 20 and my parents had to sign for everything. I couldn't rent an apartment or get a, you know, car or anything.
Right.
So I thought, well, if I stay one more year and get a master's, then I'll be free of, you know, having my parents have to sign for it. So it kind of helped that situation too. So then my first graduate classes, I loved it. I just like, oh, this is amazing. Mm-hmm. So I, the professor that was my advisor had no money. So he said, start looking for fellowships. And so, I found this Oak Ridge Fellowship that I could go there for 6 months and do my experiments for this. And, you know, it was, so anyway, I ended up going there for 6 months during my master's, which was another great, I Well, I was the first woman engineer out of 300 chemical engineers in our Chemtech division there.
At Oak Ridge, you mean?
At Oak Ridge.
Yeah.
So they wanted to hire me because I was a known. You know, they go, okay, this woman, we know she, you know, we know that's she's going to be okay. Right?
Yeah, yeah. It's like a huge extended interview process.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Oh, we know this is going to work.
Like, yeah. So, and it was great for me because, you know, I could do all these experiments and it was all energy related and it was like graduate school, because it was DOE funded and there was plenty of money because it was a heyday of the energy crisis in the 70s. And,
I think it was related to fusion research, right? A separation technique.
I did. Yeah. So I worked in fusion, how to get tritium out of materials that were put in the reactor to breed tritium, which was then going to be recycled and used as a fuel. In fact, I wrote the first environmental impact statement for a fusion reactor.
Wow.
Yeah. I didn't want to do it, but I had to do it. I was given a job to do that.
Yeah.
So that was kind of interesting. That was that was my first design. Because I had to do design of this whole system, you know. So that was actually something that played a role later on in teaching. I had that experience, which was really came in handy.
Which part, the writing the environmental statement or just the experience at Oak Ridge?
Doing the design for that environmental impact, because there was, you know, there was a reactor, but it was the rest of it, all the facilities around it, the chemical plant, basically, that I had to design. Mm-hmm. So anyway, that was very cool. So then I worked at Oak Ridge and I was just going to work a couple years because I really liked graduate school and I thought about, you know, getting my PhD and all that, but it was so much fun working there. I ended up working for 7 years until basically the environment changed and money was, you know, short and projects were being taken away from me.
And then it kind of comes in cycles at national labs, right? There's 5-10 years of lots of funding because we have this big problem that we have to solve, and then I know it shifts away, but I suppose it shifts over to academia in the meantime, or it just sort of gets lost in the ether?
So what happens, I mean, the Department of Energy will have different things that they're interested in. Mm-hmm. So what was very, again, another beneficial thing is that because we wrote internal proposals, but DOE would tell us, I'm interested in fusion, I'm interested in, you know, hydrocarbon fuel tech, you know, whatever their list was.
Right.
And we would come up with research projects to help with those initiatives and get the money. So probably every year or year and a half, we would get the engineers, my group, probably like 10 of us, would get together in a room and do a think tank. We would just like, okay, here's the list. You know, what do you want to do? And sometimes we'd run off to the library. We'd go, oh, let me go to the library. And we'd come back for like two or three days. And at the end of it, we would make a list of projects we thought that could be funded. Mm-hmm. And then we would get in groups and we'd write those proposals and send them out to DOE. Yeah. So I learned how to write proposals. They were internal proposals, but again, you know,
but still
the same, and how to come up with ideas, you know, here's a problem. How do you come up with a idea? And in these rooms, nothing was, you were basically told nothing is stupid. Nothing is stupid. You know, or even if it's like, you know, it's scientifically infeasible, just throw it out there anyway, you know? Yeah. So,
because there could be something to it.
There could be something to it. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that was a great experience, you know, this being able to do that, to come up with ideas, which helped me later on, because I think, you know, being a research professor, one of the first things, you might have ideas, but, you know, just how to take those ideas and make it into something that somebody wants to fund. How do you do that? You know, so I already had that kind of skill set when I came to academia, so that was that was really good. So anyway, then the money ran out and I decided I really wanted to go back for a PhD. And one of the things that when I worked at Oak Ridge, I worked with, I had this really horrible, well, it was a great experiment. It was, again, a tritium experiment. So I worked with radioactive tritium and molten lithium, because that was a breeder material. So I had molten metals that had to be encased in tubing, because I had this cycle. And so everything corroded. Everything corroded. So I was constantly going over to our materials and ceramics division and getting to know the scientists over there to say, well, what can I do about this corrosion?
Yeah.
So I got really interested in material science because their answers were just not very satisfying to me. You know?
Yeah.
It was very phenomenological. It's like, okay, we know we tried this and this worked, or you could try this, and you know, I'm like, oh, you know, I'm used to more theory and you know, some basic principles, and I just didn't see that. So I thought, there's got to be a better way, you know. So I wanted to go someplace where I could do material science and chemical engineering and work at that interface, which was except
for, that's a nice pun. I like that pun.
Yeah,
work at the interface.
Yeah. So the believe it or not, except for polymers, back in those days, nobody wanted to do that. So
nobody wanted to do which aspect of that, of the, work between those two, or work in material science?
But work between the two.
Hmm.
But Minnesota was a chemical engineering material science department. There were a couple others too that I applied to. And so, but, and they were also ranked one of the top schools. So when I went, so I got in there, and they loved my ideas, you know, because I said, I want to have a material science professor as my PI, but I want to do chemical engineering. They're like, ooh, that sounds great. And so all my classmates, they were like, what are you doing? What are you taking? Because I took all the core material science classes, plus all the core chemi classes. But I didn't take, some of it I didn't take for credit, because I just took, they're like, what are you doing? You know?
Yeah, I just wanted to know that.
I said, I'm going to call myself a material scientist. I'm going to do work in material science. Anyway, the faculty, they loved it. It was just so great. They were just like, do it. So anyway, that was a great experience. I mean, I was a, you know, kind of an older student coming back. Oh, and then you'll get this 7 years later, right? Two of us in the PhD.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So,
you mean 7 years later, as in 7 years after your master's while you were at Oak Ridge, and then you came back.
Right.
And it was still two.
There were two.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the pipeline was pretty leaky as far as women. So, and then, you know, kind of my last year there, a couple of my colleagues, you know, other fellow graduate students, we all were talking about teaching and going to academia and things like that. And none of us had taught. I mean, it was even hard to TA there. I mean, you know, your research professor did not want you doing anything besides research. So I went to the chair of the department and I said, I want to teach something. So he said, I will, and there was another friend of mine, Dave Graves, who is at Berkeley. Well, he just left Berkeley for Princeton, but he's been at Berkeley for this whole, our whole career in academia. So both of us were older students, had come back, and we both wanted to teach. So they allowed us to do lectures.
Wow.
You know, we could do all the lectures, but we could give like maybe one lecture a week. So that was so great that they allowed us to do that. And I think now they made it, you know, they have more of a formal program for people who really, you know, want to go into academia, that you could, you know, I said, I don't want to, I don't want a grade paper. So I want a lecture.
Right. Right.
And so they allowed us to, the both of us, to do that. And,
yeah, I know
so that
Penn State had that dedicated sort of pipeline, and, and even now, like UC San Diego, we've kind of got one, right, where they can take like a 501 class to co-teach a course with somebody.
Right. Yeah. So, so I felt very lucky there, maybe because I was a, you know, older student, and I kind of like just said, oh, I'm going to do this. I'm going to do
it. Hey, it's worked so far.
All right. So, so that was, it turned out to be a great experience. You know, It was, I mean, there's always some negative parts. I mean, the competition was ruthless in classes. I mean, our first fluids class, we got something assigned and you're supposed to go read an article that was in the library and it was ripped out of the journals.
Wow.
And if you told your professor, they'd say, oh, too bad, you know.
Really?
Yeah. Because, you know, it's like, can't you make a copy of it and give it to everybody? Yeah. If that's okay. Yeah. You know, you were just, if you didn't have a cohort of other people who knew all this stuff, it was pretty deadly. Yeah. And so anyway, I just did the best I could in the situation, you know, like, and I, of course, as always, you know, you find your study group and people who, you know, you can communicate with and work with and, you know, I was doing research from day one, my advisor and I just said, hey, I want to do research right away. I don't want to wait until I've taken the qualifier exam or anything like that. So I just, so, you know, I was doing research from day one. So that was good.
Yeah, I think that sort of research cohort, you know, it looks different at the undergraduate level, right? It's more who can I work with on homework and studying and stuff like that. But it's been something sort of at the forefront of my mind, thinking about what our students are trying to go through, of how difficult it must be to get that sort of a group started if you just came in as a freshman student, or you know, maybe a sophomore or junior who didn't have that group set up strongly before COVID hit. And it's one more reason to be so thankful that these good vaccines are coming through, because like you said, it's so hard to do any of this on your own.
Yeah.
I mean, hopefully there are fewer people right now who are actively sabotaging your learning. But,
well, they weren't picking on me particularly. They were just sabotaging. It was just like the others. Yeah. Right. So, so it was, you know, it was like stories you heard about medical school, and I really complained to the chair at the time about it. I just said, you know, but I think there was sort of like, you know, it was like medical school. Well, everybody's gone through this, and this is, you know, the expectation. Like,
But that doesn't mean that that's the best way to do it.
Yeah, like, it wasn't the best way.
Just because something has been done doesn't mean it needs to keep being done.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. Exactly.
So you mentioned that the pipeline was still sort of leaky, right? From MS to doctorate. I think it's gotten better if we just look at numbers. But what changes have you seen? Like, has it been a concerted effort to make it better, or has it just sort of evolved over time?
Oh, I think there's a lot of effort to make it better. Mm-hmm. And it's still, so, you know, when I came to UCSD, so I thought I wanted to go into academia, but I was very skittish about the whole thing. Mm-hmm. And so I actually interviewed at National Labs, where I felt very comfortable at National Labs, and also companies. And I had offers from companies, a couple companies, two National Labs, and two or three universities. Mm-hmm. So I had to really make this decision of like how my career was going to go forward. So I was very lucky. You know, I think, again, people, if you go to a good school like Minnesota or Berkeley, or, you know, your PI is well known, it really opens a lot of doors for you as far as going into an academic job, any job, but an academic job for sure. So, but I was hired on affirmative action at UCSD.
Yeah.
So there were no women in one woman in computer science, Fran Berman. Yeah. And then they got, you know, MAE, which was, whatever it was at the time. Anyway, they got a affirmative action hire, so they could hire a woman. And so I was hired under that purview of affirmative action. And they would not have hired me if they did not have that.
Yeah, I was going to pick on the way that you said that was they got an affirmative action hire so they could hire a woman. So which implies that if they didn't have that, they could not have done it. Was the reason they could not have done it a formal rule, or it was just so entrenched?
It was so entrenched. And I mean, I've had faculty members in MAE, that's, you know, where my colleagues were for a lot of my career, basically come to me and say, you know, that was a good thing that we did.
I mean, that's not like, I mean, thank you, but that's not like a glowing, I don't know. Like, that's the best you can say is, well, that was a good thing.
Yeah. So, but I, Katja Lindenberg, who was in chemistry, she just retired recently from chemistry. She was a mentor to me. So I knew women, well, she had a family, you know, she had children, and, I knew she, you know, I saw her path, right? And I think this is really important for any person who's in a minority. If you don't see a path, it's really hard to imagine yourself in these positions. But if you see the path, you know, somebody has done this. I know she got tenure. I know she had, you know, kids and got tenure. Right. I saw her be a full professor. I saw her be the chair of the Academic Senate. You know, I saw her become distinguished professor. So when you see the path, you go, okay, you know, it's possible. Right. It's possible. So I think that's really important. And that's what I felt like in my career. You know, even if you don't want to be, you are a role model, and you have to embrace that. If you don't, you know, it's kind of sad, because you are just by your existence being the only one. And you need to make that path the best for anyone to follow, and let them see there is a path, you know, to success.
Yeah.
So
yeah, whether you're actively promoting yourself as that trailblazer, that role model,
it's there.
People are watching what you're doing.
Right. Yeah. Right. And you know, for me, all the men were watching. I mean, that's all they were. They were all watching to see, you know, how I was going to fare. Mm-hmm. So I felt there was a lot of pressure, I think, to say the right thing, to do the right thing, look the right way. You know, I mean, it got a lot easier even when there were like three or four other women, because, you know, then, I could have a personality.
Right.
I could be like myself, you know?
Yeah.
But at first it was very hard. It was because I needed to be kind of this icon of what a woman engineer was to all these people.
And my guess is on the other side, with the men that you worked with, it was, I need to also behave basically the way men do in the field.
Right.
Because there's nobody
better.
Else around.
Yeah. Better. Better.
Do everything they can do and better.
And better. Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, And I, you know, we didn't have a formal mentoring process like that. I mean, Stan Middleman hired me. Dave Miller was there. They're two great people. But they really didn't, they were guys, right? And they were used to guys. So I would just plop myself down in their office. I'd come in. I'd look on Stan's desk. I go, what is that? He goes, oh, that's, you know, a thing. I'm writing a proposal. I go, well, how do you do that? How do you find out about that? You know, I just would go in, Dave Miller, you know, go to his lab. Well, how did you get that piece of equipment? You know,
Where'd that come from? What was the
nobody story? Told me how to do anything.
Right.
You know, cause they didn't, nobody knew that they needed to tell you. They don't remember. They didn't remember being told anything. Mm-hmm. They all had a mentor, but they didn't know it. Right. That told them how to do things. So I just made them into mentors. They didn't know it. Maybe they finally know it, but I was a pest.
Same thing we were talking about a minute ago. Whether they know it or not,
they are
now a mentor.
Yeah, they are mentors. Yeah. And, you know, just how do you teach? I would just ask them all kinds of, you know, constant questions. I mean, I wouldn't waste a lot of their time. I would go in with something specific, but I would just kind of like, do you have a minute? You know, whatever it was. So
just lean over and put your finger on the little receiver of the phone. Like, excuse me, do you have a minute now?
Yeah. And, you know, and I would really check out what they were working on their desk. You know, I would like, what are they doing? You know, and then I go, okay, I can do that. You know, I get back to my desk. But so it was a lot of learning, by just asking tons of questions of how things worked at the university, how to get money, you know, how to get students, just the whole thing, how to set up a lab. I mean, I didn't know any of that.
I imagine UC San Diego was a little bit smaller at that time, right?
Oh, yeah, a lot smaller.
So do you think that I see an obvious benefit, you know, to the larger scale of society and serving people and helping people to have more students going through our system. Do you think it comes at certain drawbacks of you sort of lose that ability to interact with faculty and really find yourself a mentor as you go through a program like this?
You mean as a student, a mentor?
As a student.
Yeah, I think it's harder for sure. I mean, I knew for years all my students' names.
Yeah.
And I knew something about them, all of them. Mm-hmm. You know, that, I mean, I felt for, you know, I'd say they're my golden years, you know, for teaching, because I knew all the students. Mm-hmm. And I talked to them every day, all the students. I knew all the graduate students in the program. And the faculty, I mean, still there's a lot of faculty, but I knew faculty everywhere. People will say, how do you know all these people? You know, there weren't that many people when I first started.
Right.
You know, a couple hundred faculty you can get to know. You can go to seminars in other departments. I would go to seminars in physics and chemistry. You know, if there was something in sociology, I'd go, you know, and you would meet the people, right? And so I was very recognizable. I was the woman engineer, right? So people knew me on campus because, you know, I was kind of a strange person. the weirdo, you know.
Not strange, Jan, just different.
But yeah, it's different. But I, you know, and I love people. I mean, that's one of the greatest things for me in this career is I get to meet so many people and get to learn so many things. And I enjoy people a lot. So that's been harder, you know, and I feel like as in the more recent years when there's been so many students, I probably still know the same number of students, you know?
Right.
But now there's so many of them. And I feel that's
a fraction of the class.
So it's just a fraction. So I still may know 30 students, right? But now out of 200, or that's ridiculous, or 100, right? So, but I think the students have the same issue as always. You know, you can hide very easily on our campus. You could do that even when it was small and not have any contact with faculty members. But why not? Because most of us, I mean, I'd say all of us, even people who are super busy and seem like they don't care, they really like students.
Yeah.
They really do.
It's been one of the silver linings for Zoom lectures for me is when students come to my office hours or ask questions, not very many of them ask questions in lecture, but a few of them do. But I always immediately know their name and I can put a name to a face.
Right.
And even pre-COVID, I was trying to think of ways to basically incentivize students to wear name tags for me.
Yeah.
Because it's like, I want to know your name and I will get to know you as a person, right? So that if I bump into you across campus, I know you, I know what we've worked on and I know which classes we've had and that sort of stuff. But I just can't keep up with the, you know, 120 new names every 4 weeks or so is quite challenging. And so I was trying to think of a way to incentivize them, you know, course credit or something like that. I could really put a name to a face back when we were in person.
But now you have that. So I mean, when I taught senior design, of course, for many years, and that was one of the greatest benefits was having teams. And then I would be, you know, the mentor for four or five, six teams, how many teams we would have. Mm-hmm. And I got to know those students.
Yeah.
I loved it. You know, that was like the best. That was the best part. So
that was one of the strangest disconnects for me was in while you were, you know, in 124 and I was over in 176, I've encountered the same teams as you, but I would never have a point where they would hand me a piece of paper or something and they'd say, these are our names. Right. So it was a strange way to get to know a group of people for me, because I knew them very well. I knew how they worked together. I could, you know, walk over and know enough about how their conversation was going to know if things were going well or poorly. But I didn't know their names, because there was never a time where I had a name and a face that goes together. And I, as the years went on, I finally would just start asking them, right? I would keep track of which team is where, and I would review their names right before I went over there and talked to them. Like, I have to make an effort here.
You know, for me, I could just say I'm kind of senile, so just tell me your name over and over again until I get it. I would just ask them, what's your name again? What's your name? Yeah. Okay, finally I would get it, you know? So, but I wasn't proud of, like, not knowing. I just would ask them.
Yeah.
What's your name? So, especially when you have so many students.
Yeah, I can see the advantages of, you know, the bigger schools and the bigger classes and that sort of stuff. But when I look back at my experiences where I graduated with, I think, less than 20 students in our class in Akron, as we mentioned before, I don't think I would trade any experience of that for a bigger classroom. It's not that they don't both come with pros and cons, but I really enjoyed being able to know people that way for 4 years. And I think the faculty enjoyed being able to know us too.
Yeah. No, I think, like I said, I think it's pretty rare for faculty to be able not to be interested in their students, you know, so.
It's going to be an uncomfortable few decades in academia if they don't like students.
Yeah, exactly.
Was there, you said you were generally a pretty good student, right? Coming in, it was, you said when you did something bad, it was a B, right?
That
was
in high school.
Yeah.
Not in college.
Well, okay. So that, I think, is pretty much what I wanted to ask, which is, for me, when I transitioned from high school to college, the same tools didn't work anymore, right? The sort of coasting through. And for me, that wall was, I think, material and energy balances, where you just realize, like, I have no idea what's going on, because all I do is show up and I listen to the lecture and just kind of, you know, float my way through it. Did you have a particular experience like that where you hit a wall and said, I gotta relearn how I learn because this isn't working for me? Or any particular challenge through the undergrad?
So I was not, like I said, I had nobody telling me anything about college. So for me, college was, I got away from my family. I had a job, you know, and I liked this class. I liked my classes, but I had a really good time, you know, and I went to parties and I was
at Penn State. Yeah, they had parties at Penn State.
So, and you know, I was really, I like, you know, I still like arts and theater. I was really into theater. I was a usher at the theater, and then I knew people downtown who were ushers at theaters and could, you know, movie theaters. Like, I saw all the, you know, foreign movies and anyway, and then I would study. So for me, my goal was to graduate, you know, with a decent, I thought, GPA and get a job. So when I heard about graduate school and that you had to have a 3.0, I had a 2.96.
Gave you something to shoot for there.
Pardon?
It gave you something to shoot for there.
No, it was never going to, I was never going to get a 3.0.
Oh, really?
Yeah. No, it was impossible. I failed organic chemistry twice, and you only can take a class three times. I took it my last quarter senior year. And by then, though, I learned how to study better. So I just had put it off because I was so afraid of it. And, you know, so, and I say fail. I mean, I got D's, but you couldn't, you know, it's failing, right?
Right.
So I failed as many classes as I had AP credit for.
There's a certain balance to that, certain symmetry to it.
I was clueless. I mean, it wasn't, you know, if somebody said, oh, Jan, you're going to get a C or a B, I'd go, why, you know, if I had to work a little harder to get the B or an A, or I don't know. It just never clicked. Why would I have to do that? Right.
Right.
So it clicked, you know, and so when I applied to graduate school, you know, I didn't have the requirements. So I went to the chair of the department and I said, I didn't know.
Right.
So he goes, so I was let in on probationary status. You know, and I did okay. I did fine in the GREs and whatever. So, but yeah. So I loved graduate school. I got all A's. So it wasn't like I couldn't do it. I tell our students when I taught Seng 4, because a lot of them were like me, you know, first time college students, their parents don't know anything about college. Right. They may not have a mentor or somebody knows about college. I say, please get a 3.0.
Yeah.
Because if you don't, it closes doors, like to graduate school. It closes doors. So if you
may not know what those doors are right
you
now.
You don't know. Yeah. You know, I could have just worked a little bit harder, you know, but I had a lot of, when I think about it, I think, how did I work 15, 20 hours a week and, you know, take all these classes and go to all the parties? I don't know how I did it. You know, so, yeah. So anyway, I learned how to study in graduate school, really. I mean, I already knew, but I just didn't really have the motivation to, you know, go further.
Right.
And it was really interesting. There's a guy in my class, Mike Malone, who's a professor at UMass. I think he's still there. Anyway, he was the golden boy. You know, he got asked to be in research labs and I would watch him, you know, I think like, he doesn't look like he's having fun. You know?
Let's just put all the cards on the table. It doesn't look like you're enjoying this.
You know, it's not like, but you know, he had a lot of opportunities.
Yeah.
And then later on, you know, I met him and I said, did you ever think about how differently we were treated in in undergraduate? And he's like, no, you know, I wasn't really on his radar. He just said, I knew you were the woman in the class, but you know, there was no expectation. And years later, Penn State asked me to come back to give a seminar when they learned I was a faculty member at UCSD. So I thought, yeah, I want to go back. And it was like going to your grade school, you know, it's like, oh, the little chairs look so little. Yeah. I don't know. Anyway, you know, it was kind of that experience. But there were several faculty that were still there who hadn't retired yet, or on the verge of retirement, who came to my seminar. And three or four of them actually pulled me aside, you know, separately to say, I apologize.
Really?
Yeah. I had no idea. I had no expectation for you to, I mean, one guy used to every quarter, oh, you're back.
Like you're back, like in the sense that, oh, you came back to class.
You came back to class. You're back. Yeah, it was, you know, so I really took that to heart. And I said, well, you know, it was a different time. It was a really different time, you know. And it was kind of funny because I did things. I still am this way, right? So like, say in chemistry lab, we had to do 5 experiments in 10 weeks.
Sure.
I read the experiments. I said, why does it take so long to do these experiments?
Yeah.
So I did them in 2 weeks. So my TA came over and he goes, what experiment are you doing? I go, I'm doing these 3. He goes, well, no one's ever done that. I go, well, why not?
Why not? I'm here.
Why not? I said, I can do it. Yeah. You know,
that crystallization process takes 50 minutes of just looking.
I'm waiting. I could be doing something. I could do another experiment. So, you know, so I finished that lab in 2 weeks, and you know, they had never seen anything like that. And the same with our senior lab. You know, you'd be waiting and waiting. I'd go over and I'd go, why would you do it this way? Why don't you? You know, I go, oh, no one's ever thought of it. You know? Yeah. So I think they didn't really know what to make of me in a lot of ways, yeah. because I obviously had this curiosity and intellect that most students would just go, okay, you know, I'll do this, turn this knob, and, you know, and that's what you're supposed to do. But yeah. That's not how I saw these experiments at all. Yeah. You know, I'm like, why would you do that when you can do this?
Yeah.
And they're like, oh, okay.
No, I would love to see somebody do that in like 176, because it's all set up that you can't really break it too much.
Yeah.
But if you do something, you get a weird result from what you were thinking, you'll learn so much.
Yeah. I've had to actually, when I did 176, of course, we had sort of a different setup, but mm-hmm. I had students who would do that. They'd go, you know, what if I did this instead? I go, try it, you know?
Yeah. See what happens.
See what happened. Yeah. And so, and, you know, sometimes it would be something positive. I'd say, hey, you know, we'll do that in the next experiments for the next mm-hmm. groups. Or other times it would be like, nah, you don't want to do that. You know, so, but I think, anyway, that's just the way I thought all the time. And so, anyway, but it was very nice that those faculty, I took it to heart, you know, that they kind of understood what they didn't do.
Yeah. Yeah, you know. They took that minute to think about the way they would have treated somebody coming through their program. Yeah.
But anyway, getting back to the question, I think, you know, definitely there's more women. Mm-hmm. And I think partly is if you can get a woman in these positions, there's mm-hmm. a path. And so women are encouraged. But, you know, it was kind of interesting. Shirley Meng and I were at a Gordon conference, a Gordon Research Conference. Mm-hmm. And it's one that I started actually many, many years ago on electrodeposition, and Shirley was an invited speaker, and we were sitting at lunchtime, you know, you kind of sit around with different people. We're sitting at a lunch table. We're the two faculty members. The rest were the graduate students. We asked people what they were going to do when they graduated. There was one guy and like four women. Mm-hmm. One guy said, oh, I'm going to be a faculty member. All the women said, no. Mm-hmm. You know. So Shirley and I went, this is horrible. And their reasons were just pitiful. I mean, because the guy, he had the same questions that they did about academia, but he was going to go, I'm going to academia. I'm going to try it, you know. Where they were like, oh, no, it's too scary. I said, look it. You have two successful women here. Why are you saying no? So after that, we formed a woman's table. And we said, if you want to know about academia, Shirley and I are going to be sitting here. And we, you know, it was for women, but there were actually a couple guys who would come too.
Sure.
You know,
sure.
But I have to say, I don't think we convinced one woman.
Really?
No. So it's still really difficult. And I think the questions we had were, you know, it's so competitive. Mm-hmm. I said, well, you're competitive already, you know? Mm-hmm. And then the second, but, you know, I think that's one thing that sports has really given me is like, I can be competitive. Mm. I can win. Yeah.
And that influence outside of just the sports arena has.
But I realized I would never say that. No. You know, in my job, where it was totally true, I was competitive, but mm-hmm. it was not ladylike to do that, right?
Right.
So, but I realized I can do it in sports. I can do it here. So I started being competitive, like outright competitive. You know, mm-hmm. I'm competing with you. Watch it. You know, but women, just that whole competitive thing is very scary. And then, you know, being assertive is really mm-hmm. scary. And then having a family and trying to juggle all that is really scary. Mm-hmm. So there's still a lot of barriers. Mm-hmm. But now I think what women see, you know, when they're an undergraduate, they see women faculty. You know, I never saw a woman faculty member.
Right.
Ever. In my whole career. Mm-hmm. Until I got to UCSD and I met Katja, you know, didn't know anybody didn't have that experience. And then, so they can see that. They can see women graduate students. They can see women in industry. So there are paths.
Right.
There are paths, you know. So But, you know, not long ago, I had a master's student. She went to a company, startup company, very successful. She got a big bonus because she had written this program that, you know, blew the socks off of all her workers. And she came to me and she says, Jan, I don't think I'm going to stay here. And I said, why? She goes, there's only one other woman. She's in Long Beach in a professional sense in the company. And I asked my boss, you know, what's my career path? And he said, why do you want to know? So she went.
That was the response. Why do you want to know?
Yeah. Why do you want to know? You're doing okay. Why do you want to know? So she said, I'm going to go to, I forget where she went, but like a big, you know, like HP or some big company. Mm-hmm. And she said, I'm going to that company because my boss would be a woman. One of her bosses is a woman. And the CEO, one of this, you know, vice presidents, excuse me, is, you know, a woman. Right. I have a path.
Yeah.
And so nobody can say, you know, oh, you know, why do you want to know that?
Yeah.
I have a path. So, yeah. I think that's really critical still for women is to see, and for minorities, you know, to see a path, to see that people have made it. And, you know, not that it's maybe, even if it was really excruciating and horrible experience for them, at least you know it's possible. You know?
Right.
Yeah. So.
Do you think that's where, I think I just checked the numbers for our particular department because we kind of keep track of these for our new students when they're, you know, interested in the program. We talk about the gender gap in our particular program. And I think we've been around like 35-40% for quite a few years.
So that's very good. I mean, that's really good.
Computer science really has a pretty big problem with it right now.
It's terrible.
I mean, they've called it a crisis in computer science of having basically no one but men continuing on with computer science right now. And it's this self-fulfilling or I guess self-feeding cycle of not having any representation in their program. Do you think at the undergraduate level there's still stuff that we could do that's sort of staring us in the face that we're not doing that could help improve representation just across the board too, not in any particular group?
When I taught 176, I first thought, oh, disperse all the women. Mm-hmm. Wrong. Yeah, because what happens if you're the only woman in a team, especially doing experiments, you hardly get any hands-on unless you're really, really assertive. Mm. So I put women together in teams. Mm-hmm. And it was fascinating. Yeah. So you want at least two women together on a team. Mm. Because then they have at least each other to bolster and push each other to if they want to do something.
Right.
If it's just one of them, it's very difficult. It's really difficult. So, but I made teams of all women, and it was, you know, so we had things like posters and web pages. I think one time we did web pages, you know.
Yeah.
And they would come in with pink, right? Everything would be pink.
Yeah.
And the guys, the faculty and the guys would go, this is engineering. You can't have pink.
Yeah.
You can't have flowers. And it's like, why not?
But why not? Like, Yeah.
And
as long as I can read what you've done, I mean, it's.
But it was just amazing.
Yeah.
This stereotype that keeps getting pushed ahead. You know what I mean? And now I see teams with guys where they have flowers and pink and, you know, cool stuff. So that I think has changed, but it wasn't changing until the women were together and they felt like they could do something. It sounds simple, right? It sounds simple, but the visceral response to it is not simple.
Yeah.
You know?
And that's something that I think Justin followed on after He learned it from you, and then I learned it from Justin. So we've continued that right on down through till I assume he's doing it right now. He's actually teaching 176 this year. I've for the first time in like 7 years, I am not teaching that course, but yay, I get to try something new.
Yeah, it's good to have to do something new.
But yeah, it's
ongoing. But I think the team experiences, I think it's great to have guys in the teams be, you know, have women on their team, but one woman is just not it. And it's interesting, the teams that have three, like we had three women and one guy one time. Oh, he was so uncomfortable. Oh, really? It was excruciatingly painful for him. Mm. Yeah. He did not want to be on that team. And I just would say, just think, I had no women to work with for many, many years. Just think about that, you know?
Yeah.
So so I don't want to make people uncomfortable. You know, I did that was sort of an experiment. And I thought this guy would, he handled it. He was definitely a person who could handle it, but he had a hard time. Yeah. He had a hard time. So I thought, you know, it's not about making people feel uncomfortable. It's making people feel comfortable, but in a positive way, right? So I think women teams is great, really a great thing to women. I think that they get an opportunity to learn a lot about themselves in the when there's more than one. You know, they're not just kind of upholding whatever they have to do to be with all these guys and the teams. And that just, it's changing, but it's really slow.
Yeah.
Really slow.
Alyssa and I were talking last year. There's always a few teams that they're just sort of at loggerheads the whole time. And I think, you know, she and I were talking and she asked me, how do you know when to split a group up? You know, if something's going really wrong, how do you know? And I said, I don't have, there's no metric by which I say, okay, it's now time to set that up, because there is a certain amount of, I guess, uncomfortableness, for lack of a better word, of how do I learn to act professionally around a group of people that I may not get along with, I may not share very many things, but I've been tasked with a problem and I have to work with them. So I have to find a way to do that. And I it sounds like that's where the one gentleman was in the group of three women. But yeah, every once in a while there's been maybe two teams over 6 years where it's gotten to the point where it's like people are calling names. You're not going to be able to pull this out in 3 or 4 weeks or 5 weeks or something like that. And they finally have. I've separated them somehow. But it's really kind of a last resort, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think I've only had one team I had to blow up one time. I mean, because you're right. They're going to have to, they're not going to be working with their friends in wherever they're going to be working, in graduate school or industry. They're going to be working with they're going to be working with old people.
Who won't we don't say it like that.
who have no clue what they're talking about, you know. Yeah. It's going to be a big challenge.
Yeah. Big challenge. So you're a professor emerita now.
I am.
You can more or less decide to come back at your discretion, right? If you want to teach something and there's something to teach, then it's sort of there for you to do it. Have you thought about coming back to teach anything?
No.
No,
I mean, I love teaching. I mean, I could probably do a lecture once in a while, I think. But, you know,
you can come back and work with me on Sense 4. It's a great class.
Yeah, I like that class. But, you know, I feel like all of the young people like yourself are so great at it, you know?
Well, thank you.
I do.
I can't say like, thank you for everyone, but thank you.
No, I think, you know, we did a really good job of hiring amazing young people. I mean, it's a different world. It's from when I started. I remember when I started, Dave Miller would tell me, you know, oh, it's a different world. It's so easy to get money for research. And, you know, I had these small classes. Now you got these big classes, you know. And I, you know, I would think, huh, I can do all this.
Yeah.
But now I feel like him. I feel like, I don't think I want to do all that, you know?
Yeah, just, right.
It's a different world, different skills that you have to have. And, you know, I mean, I feel like I would be teaching kind of history of chemical engineering, you know, in a way. So, but I like being a sage and spreading any wisdom I have and giving advice. I like going to lunch with seminar speakers and telling them the history of UCSD and chemical engineering and things like that, you know. So I have things like, you know, I like mentoring women if I have that chance, that opportunity. But I even think for women, it's luckily things have changed a lot. They've changed a lot. And so that's good. So I think a lot of my experiences are history. They're really, really kind of, you know, how things were done in a pioneering way.
You know, so. Well, I for one would certainly like to thank you for being my mentor when we were working together at UCSD, because to have you, I think you're like four doors down or five doors down. I still remember those first few years. I would kind of walk down the hallway while I was still a new faculty member, and I kind of look around and be like, oh, good, her door's open, and knock on her door and be like, hey, Jan, do you have a minute? Can I talk to you about something? It was invaluable. And I can't thank you enough for that.
That's part of the job that I really love. So it was really great. You know, I think mentoring graduate students, undergraduates, and faculty, new faculty, and, you know, this just really makes the job. I mean, I get to be around such smart people. Your brain is always working. So that's what a great place to work, I must
say.
Yeah.
Well, I think we're coming up on our roughly hour or so for the podcast. Do you want to wrap it up with a couple of those questions that I had emailed you out earlier? They actually come from the first episode, right before I was giving this podcast. I, for some reason, started doing research on Inside the Actor's Studio with James Lipton, and I remember he used to ask a bunch of these. But then I actually looked into these questions because I thought, you know, I should give him credit for coming up with these questions and not steal them. But they don't actually know where this question set came from. There's like four or five different people who are asking it around the same time, and then he took it from them. So that's roughly what it was modeled after.
Yeah.
But just for
anybody
who was worried that I was plagiarizing these questions, like, we don't actually know who came up with these questions first. So I keep it a little bit shorter than his whole list of 10 or so or something like that. So what is your favorite word?
Well, if I have my academic hat on, it's electrochemistry.
Of course, a good choice.
And when I don't have my academic hat on, it's adventure.
Adventure, yeah. So I guess we didn't actually get, you know, the podcast is, you know, more talking about early life in education, not your considerable career afterwards in electrochemistry. But for the students who are listening, electrochemistry is a pretty big part of your life, yes?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that's where my research went to from graduate school on. And I must say that if I hear that word, my ears perk up. I remember I had a graduate student who didn't know anything about electrochemistry. So I gave him John Newman's book, which is on electrochemical engineering. And I said, here, read this book and come in and we'll talk. And, you know, he came in and we start talking and I go, I just love electrochemistry. And he was like, you love electrochemistry? I go, yeah. I think he still wanted to work with me, but it was like pretty scary. I'm sort of the same way. If somebody goes, you know, an adventure? Adventure.
Adventure. And I guess, so the corollary to that then, of course, is what's your least favorite word?
cancer. I'm a cancer survivor.
Yeah.
So don't want to hear that word.
No, no, I imagine not. And now for the next one, we will go back in after we record everything and beep anything that you want. So I always encourage everyone to say what they're thinking. What is your favorite curse word?
Fa-la-la-la-la.
Okay, now how much of that do you want me to beep?
Guess what that means.
Yes, we will leave it to the imagination of our audience what to make of that. I still love there were two reactions that I've gotten for that over this podcast. One is just sheer joy to be able to talk about it. And then the other one is sort of like a nervous laughter of, I can't believe I'm about to say this right now. It's been so fun to listen to.
Well, my son, you know, he went to the school for the blind and they couldn't curse at all. So he was the language police when I was home. So I had to think of other like things to like, fa la 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 la.
Yes.
He comes here. Here comes the language police. We're going to arrest you. But actually, the worst word was stupid.
Was it?
Yeah. 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 So that was a word that was not allowed at all. I thought that was really, really good.
So that was actually, I think, the only word in my fifth grade English class. I mean, there were obviously all of the usual words that you couldn't say as part of school, but my English teacher had a special word for the word stupid, or a special rule for the word stupid, and you would have to write, I think, 500 word essays every time he heard you say it.
Oh my gosh.
It can be a damaging word. Damaging word. Yeah. And what career other than your own might you like to pursue?
Well, you know, I actually had a student who worked over at the Qualcomm Institute. Anyway, there was a big kind of thing. She needed an advisor and she was in material science. And I went, oh my gosh, this would have been like the perfect career. So she basically looked at how ancient paintings and, you know, antiquities, the materials in them, and also with the thing of restoration and understanding the kind of the artist palette. So she used all these modern, you know, SEMs, ATMs, you know, blah, blah, spectroscopies off the wazoo to figure out, you know, how a painting was made back centuries ago. So got to go to the Uffizi in, where is it? Not Venice. Florence, in Florence. And hang out there looking at all these paintings and taking minute little samples that you couldn't tell where they were. She has a job like that now, working for some art gallery, art museum. And I thought it would combine material science, chemistry, kind of an art, you know.
Yeah,
it would have been. I think that's what I would have liked to have done.
Yeah, no, that sounds like, now I hear about it, I'm like, that does sound fascinating.
Yeah,
it's one of those positions. It's really how I first heard of my position in our position, really, of being a professor. You don't realize that there's a job out there that's like that.
No.
And until you hear about it and realize how many of those little boxes of your own that it ticks, you don't even think to pursue something like that.
You know, it might be boring. It might, you know, I think, again, like anything with chemistry and, you know, when you're doing, there's got a lot of tedium in it.
Yeah.
But I still think it would have been, if I could have done that with a big masterpiece hanging, you know, behind me, I probably would have been, okay, I'm fine, you know. But, and like this job as a professor, you're not, I stopped working in the lab very early on just because, you know, the students were much more efficient and I just had to go in and troubleshoot. And there were other things I needed to spend my time on, like, you know, writing proposals and papers and stuff. So I'm sure that job would be the same, where I wouldn't have to do all the hands-on later on too, which would, but I, oh, to that, I think that would have been such a good fit.
Yeah. That does sound really interesting.
Yeah. So there are people at Qualcomm that do that. I mean, they, So I forget the guy's name that is involved in it, but they, they're always trying to, they're doing sleuthing, you know, to figure out if there's
artwork
behind this mosaic, you know, how can they figure out without destroying the mosaic and like Van Gogh's irises, they used to be red, but now they're pink. You know, why is that? You know, they're trying to. So it's just really interesting questions that are scientific questions, but concerning artwork, you know. So
anyway. It took me a minute to process what you said. I thought like his, the eyeballs that he drew on his people.
No, the irises. Red, oh, no. Like the flower. Yeah. The
flower. Like, I don't remember him being quite so, aggressive.
The flowers. Yeah.
The corollary to that in, then is what profession other than your own would you least like to attempt?
I still don't want to be a waitress.
the answer still holds.
Yeah, it still holds. Much rather be a health phys technician than waitress, though. Yeah, still holds.
Well, Dr. Jan Talbot, thank you so much for spending an afternoon with us for our students. It's been such a pleasure.
It's been a pleasure for me, too.